This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, Case 53, by Chang's Wild Ducks, the pointer. The whole world does not hide it. His entire capacity stands alone revealed. He encounters situations without getting stuck. With every move, he has the ability to assert himself. In his phrases, there's no partiality. Everywhere, he has the intention to kill people. But say, in the end, where do the ancients go to rest? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look, the main case. Once when Great Master Matsu and Pai Cheng were walking together, they saw some wild ducks fly by. The Great Master asked, "What is that?" Pai Cheng said, "Wild ducks." The Great Master said, "Where have they gone?" Pai Cheng said, "They've flown away." Matsu then twisted Pai Cheng's nose, and Cheng cried out in pain. Matsu said, "When have they ever flown away?" The verse. Wild ducks, who knows where they are? Matsu saw them coming, and they had words with each other. He told all about the scene of the clouds on the mountains and the moon over the sea. As before, Chang didn't understand, but said, "They've flown away." Pai Cheng wanted to fly away, but Matsu held him fast. "Speak, speak." Where do the ancients go to rest? I spoke about this a little bit yesterday. By the way, I think yesterday I misspoke and talked about, I either said that Kuei Shan had formulated the monastic rules in the Zen tradition, which is wrong, or I said Pai Cheng did. Is that what I said? Yeah. So it was all jumbled up. So... Pai Cheng wasn't involved in the talk yesterday. So Pai Cheng is the one who is said to have developed those first monastic rules. So if people listen to yesterday's talk and not today's, they, it's my fault. So yesterday we spoke a little bit about rest, the great rest. Where do the ancients go to rest? Recognizing that samsara is a full-time, exhausting endeavor. And so where do we go to rest? And what is true rest? Rest that allows us to be enlivened and engaged fully. You know, look at the lives of these old masters. They were pretty high-spirited horses. And so that rest is really to not just free us, but free all of this tremendous energy, spiritual life that we have within us to be in life, to be alive. And the pointer, he's talking really about Matsu here, but he's really talking about these qualities that we are bringing forth within our own practice. The whole world does not hide it. His entire capacity stands alone revealed, to be revealed, to not be living in hiddenness. Hidden to others, to ourselves. Importantly, encounter situations without getting stuck, to be free of attachments, to phrases without partiality, where all things are seen as equal. There's one nature. Once Pai Cheng studied with Bai Zhang, and he once asked him, Bai Zhang asked him, "What is the essential import of Zen?" And Matsu said, "It's just the place where you let go of your body and your life. It's just that place, it's that very moment when you let go of your body and life, when you finally come to rest and liberate by letting go, liberate body and life. We tend to think that our attachments, when we hold something, that we bring it closer, we preserve it, we ensure that somehow it'll have more life, and it's really just the opposite on every count. And that we live within this physical body, which is powerful and resilient and frail and fragile. Here today and gone tomorrow. And because we live in this body, and the Buddha said this Dharma is subtle and profound and can't be understood through the senses, which includes the thinking mind, and we practice letting go of our attachments to everything that comes through our senses, that really all of that is so that we can enter fully into this body and understand it as it really is, use it as it really has been given to us to use. And life is just that larger body to do the same. And so where the breath, a sensation, an emotion, a feeling, a taste, a touch can be perpetuating samsara on the one hand, but it can also be liberating us from samsara. Same breath, same emotion, same taste. And that's why Buddhism is sort of encapsulated as ceasing from harm, practicing all that is good, and training and liberating the mind. And so here, Pai Cheng and Matsu were walking one day. They were a close teacher and student. And so in that relationship, there are many aspects. There's respect, affinity, affection, guidance, support. But all of those different aspects that can feed into the relationship between student and teacher is ultimately serving liberation, serving the study and practice and realization of the Dharma. To be free of hiddenness and attachments and partiality. And so here they are walking along, and ducks fly overhead. And Matsu says, "What is that?" He knows what they are. Why does he ask? Right, I spoke about this with Kui Xiong and Master Liu yesterday, that these conversations, I mean, they didn't know this was going to end up in a collection of koans and that we'd be sitting here in 2019. They were just having a conversation by themselves, for themselves. He was teaching. What is that? Simple question. And Pai Cheng gave him a simple answer. Wild ducks, Master. And the footnote to that says, you should know, teacher. Indeed. Matsu should know for himself. And indeed, he does. Really, every teacher of the Dharma, first and foremost, is a student of the Dharma. Forever. Forever. Each day, each moment, this very conversation, that in teaching, the student is also being a student of the Dharma, a student of teaching, a student of their student. It is endless, it is boundless, this great way. And so Pai Cheng says, it's wild ducks, and Master Ma says, where have they gone? And I love the, and then Pai Cheng said, they've flown away. And I love this poem. You know, the poems, the language of each of these poem collections has its own quality because they were put together by, you know, specific teachers. And so the poems in the Book of Serenity are particularly beautiful. You know, that was compiled by Hong Zhu, who was really an incredible poet, as well as a teacher. And these are a little rougher, but this one is particularly nice. And so he says, "Wild ducks, master," and Matsu says, "Where have they gone?" And the poem, he versifies this and says, "Matsu saw them coming, the ducks, and they had words with each other." Is he talking about his words with Bai Cheng, or is he talking about his communication with the ducks? A subtle communication. That when we see, when we understand, there's a subtle communication. Intimate words, Dogen said. And then he goes on, these words with each other. He says, "He told all about the scene of the clouds on the mountains and the moon over the sea." What is that? Wild ducks. Where have they gone? Why does he describe this, simple words this way? That in that question, where have they gone, he's speaking to him about this scene of clouds on a mountain and a moon over the sea. This vast field of liberation, of benefaction, of wonder. Bai Cheng says, "They've flown away." And so Master Matsu takes his nose and twists it, and Bai Cheng cries out in pain. And Matsu says, "When have they ever flown away?" The footnote to "They Have Flown Away" says he's stumbled past what's right in front of him. And in a sense, this is the mantra of living in distractedness. We stumble past what's right in front of us. But while we stumble past and we miss it, we are seeing something. That's the thing. Right? If we stumbled past and realized, "Oh, wait a minute, I just missed something," then the door would just be opening all the time. Right? Because we know we just missed something. But the depth of samsara is that we stumble past something and we don't know that we stumble past, and so we think what we did see is what there was to see, was all there was to see. And so we just stumble again and stumble again. And we put that together in a way that works sort of all right. Right? We get things done. But something's not quite quiet. Something's not quiet. When have they ever flown away? And Sui Do in the poem says, as before, Bai Cheng didn't understand. As before, referring to when he first answered, "Wild ducks, master. What is that?" And so Bai Cheng just responded. Now, is that response not seen? He's just stumbled past? Or is it a very clear, direct response? Wild ducks. He could be speaking from stumbling past. He could be speaking from clear seeing. And so Matsu asks further, "Where did they go?" Bai Cheng says, "They've flown away." Now he knows. Now Matsu knows. And so he twists his nose. As before, Cheng didn't understand and said, "They've flown away." Bai Cheng himself wanted to fly away, but Matsu held him fast. He held him fast so that he could let go, so that he could find his stability in namelessness, signlessness, wishlessness, emptiness. You know, what we're doing here, the intensity, the rigors, the discipline, the all of it is really about that. Because we too, in our own ways, we want to fly away. Right? We encounter something difficult. Just a moment. I'll be right back. I just need a moment to fly away. I was just reading an article about this, and I'm sorry I can't remember her name, this young woman who's this really dynamite tennis player. She's Japanese and Haitian descent. Naomi Osaka, I think is her name. Anyway, she was just in this big match. I don't remember which one, but sorry, I didn't get all the details. But she was, I think she'd won a set and then she lost the second set. And so she took a bathroom break, she said. Pause. And she left the court, it said, in tears. And she's, I guess, recounting what she was doing. And she's in there thinking, saying to herself, why are you so upset? It's like you think you're entitled to win this match, right? You're playing against one of the best players in the world, right? Like see what you're in. You're in a contest, right? It's a real contest. You don't deserve to win. You have to, you know, draw on your training. She's talking to herself. I mean, she didn't say all of this. When you go read the article, you'll realize this is the fictionalized account. But then she was basically collecting herself, not flying away. She went back and she won the last round. And it was interesting because it said that her opponent was looking for her on the court to congratulate her, and she'd already left. Boom. And it was talking about her upbringing, you know, and sort of not putting the self forward. And she's also shy. So she didn't want to hang around and be the hero. Wanting to fly away, a life of so many such moments. So it's like our dukkha mind, our conditioned mind, you know, keeps saying, not here, not now, not this, not me. And Matsu held him fast, saying, yes, just here. Only now, just this, it is you. And it's hard in difficult moments to know that that is our seat of strength, that is our stability, that is our ground, being held fast. And so training helps us to do that, right? Everyone who comes in freely, you come into the Zendo, you sit freely, and in fact, you sit for 35 minutes in stillness freely. No one is making us do that, right? Yes, there is, you know, a discipline and an agreement that we're going to do that because it's going to help us as individuals and us together to go deeper into our Zazen. There is a skillfulness to that. But nothing's preventing anybody from jumping and dancing or walking out or hooting and hollering. Right? But thank you for not doing any of those things. And so we're learning how to hold ourselves fast, and in that, to do that more and more at rest. In a sense, to realize from the beginning, that's what I've been wanting. To stop flying away. So Pai Cheng cries out in pain, and Master Matsu says, when have they ever flown away? And the footnote says, right here. What did you call it? Are you conscious of the pain? Are you conscious of the pain? It's right here. So there that pain, which is suffering, which is dukkha, which is perhaps being treated unfairly from a certain view. He cries out in that moment. And then Matsu says, when have they ever flown away? And it was at that moment that Pai Cheng had realization that in the moment of pain, there was just pain. But in the moment that Pai Cheng, the Masu asked him that question went right into the core of his being and broke him open, liberated his body, liberated his pain from pain. In that moment, the ducks and the walking and the question and the answer were all unified. Why did Matsu resort to such an action? Why did he cause him pain? It's a lesser pain. As soon as Matsu let go of his nose, the pain passed. The greater pain was still there. That's the source of bodhicitta. That's what the Guardian Council is probing for students who are asking to enter to training, or monastics who want to make this their life, residents who want to come into residency. What is the greater pain? And pain here is a word that encompasses every dissatisfaction, every disappointment, every dis-ease. And so Matsu held him fast because he wanted to release him from that pain and knew that his very nature was free of that pain already. In the commentary it says, when teachers of our tradition help people, they must help them penetrate through, pass through. You see that Pai Cheng didn't understand, and yet he didn't avoid cutting his hand on the point. Matsu just wanted to help him understand this matter. Thus it said, when you understand, you can make use of it wherever you are. So because Matsu knew, he wanted to make use of it right then. He said, if you don't understand, then the conventional truth prevails. If Matsu hadn't twisted Pai Cheng's nose at that time, Pai Cheng's conventional truth would have prevailed. It's also necessary when encountering circumstances and meeting conditions to turn them around and return them to oneself, to not fly away, and to have no gaps at any time. This is called the ground of nature bright and clear. If he hadn't held him fast, if he hadn't twisted his nose, then the conventional truth would have prevailed. In other words, we would just go on seeing things as we see them. We have to be startled out, brought out. That's why in the development of the Zen tradition, these very provocative, skillful means were brought forth. Right? There are other ways, thousands, millions of other ways. So there are ways that are very startling, with a loud gesture, a loud noise, and there are ways to be startled that are so gentle, so soft. When have they ever flown away? Of course, Matsu is speaking to us. That's why Zuedo in the poem at the end says, speak, speak. He's talking to us. He's talking to whoever's studying this. He's saying, where do you find yourself? Do you hear Matsu speaking directly to you? When I was in North Carolina recently, my mom's memorial, she had asked me to officiate the memorial at her Unitarian church. So I did that along with the Unitarian minister there. We worked that out together. And I told briefly the Sutra of the Four Messengers, where this guy who did not live well in every way was brought, died, and went to the Yama, the Lord of Death, and was questioned by the Lord of Death about, you know, didn't you see the old person and the sick person and the corpse that I sent to you as messengers, that this is you, this is your life. And didn't you notice that? And didn't you reflect on it and think, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing with my life? Because that's where I'm headed. And the man kept saying, no, I didn't. I was negligent. I didn't get it. The message was sent but not received. And I said, I told that sutra, and fortunately, my mom was not like that. She was not like this guy. She lived a very good life, and she saw the messengers. She got them. The messages were sent, and they were received. And I said, but in a memorial like this, when we go to celebrate and grieve the loss of someone we care about, if we're not reflecting on our own mortality, then we're missing the gift that that person has offered us in their death. If we're not reflecting on our own death, we have flown away. How did his pain open the door to no gaps, as he says in the poem or in the commentary? We think of pain as a bad thing to get away from, and of course, pain can be extremely debilitating, corrosive. It can be a result of just our biological bodies. It can be a result of mental anguish. It can be a result of living in oppressive societies or systems. It can be something that happens between individuals. It can happen between a person and a nation. And so Buddhism has deep understanding and respect for pain because it's a real thing. But it's like when it flies by, when it appears before us, it's like Matsu saying, what is that? He's not just talking about ducks. He's saying, what is that? When we experience that one of a multitude of forms of pain, what is that? And while it's in front of us, what do we see? And when it passes, where did it go? Matsu asks us. And when we say, it went away, he grabs our nose and says, when has it ever gone away? How else will we understand? And as he says in the commentary, we have to be not unafraid to cut our hand on the point. In other words, to be unafraid to step into this. You know, in letting go of attachments, when we really listen carefully to the teachings and we hear how what is that to free ourselves, that to really let go of all attachments. The Buddha said requires fearlessness. We have to have courage, right? Because we don't want to do that. Let's just get it out there. We don't actually want to do that. But we do want to do that, and both of those are true. And so we have to have courage to step forward into that long-standing habit. But what's interesting is that, in fact, holding on to our attachments is what should give us fear. We should not be afraid of letting go of our attachments. That's what releases us from our fear. We should be afraid in every moment that we are attached. In fact, we already are afraid. In the full mondo in which this took place, there's the encounter that is brought forth in the koan. Matsu says, when did they ever fly away? And then the mondo in the record of Paijang and Baijiang says that Baijiang came to realization. And then afterwards, he went back to his room and he was crying, weeping. And another monk heard him and went in and said, what's going wrong? What's wrong? Are you homesick? And Baijiang says, no. And the student and the other monk says, was someone mean to you? And Baijiang says, no. And he says, then why are you crying? And he says, Master Ma twisted my nose so hard that the pain was unbearable. And the monk says, why did he do that? Did you do something to upset him? And Bai Sheng said, "You go ask him." He's learning well. You ask him. You find out. And so the monk goes to Matsu and says, What did Bai Cheng do to offend you? He's in his room crying. Please tell me. And Matsu says, "He knows. You go ask him." And so the monk comes back and asks Bai Cheng, and Bai Cheng says, "The master says that you already know and that I should come back and ask you." And at that point, Bai Cheng starts laughing, laughing. And the monk says, "A moment ago you were crying. Why are you laughing now?" And Bai Cheng says, "My crying a moment ago is the same as my laughing now. It's the same." There's the story of the old master who was dying. And in his dying, he was probably in a lot of pain because he was groaning and wailing. And his students were very embarrassed because, you know, he's a great master. And he's like, "You're supposed to die in dignity, you know, not like wailing." And so they try and shush him up. And he pushes them away and says, "I tell you that my crying and my wailing is just the same as my laughing." How is it the same? What is that? What is that that appears before? We shouldn't stumble past. And so Bai Cheng responds this way. Says the monk was bewildered. And so the next day, Matsu went into the Dharma hall to give a talk. And everybody assembled. They all laid out their zagus, their bowing mats, were ready for the talk. And before he could open his mouth, Bai Cheng stood up, put together his bowing mat, and left. And Bai Cheng got down from his seat, and they went in together to his room. And Matsu said, "Just now, I hadn't yet said a word. Why did you roll up your bowing mat?" And Bai Cheng said, "Yesterday, the master painfully twisted my nose." Matsu said, "Is there anything special about yesterday that you've seen?" He didn't know what had happened for Bai Cheng. Or what he wanted to do was he wanted to hear from him, "What did you see?" And Bai Cheng said, "Today, my nose doesn't hurt anymore. Yesterday, you twisted it painfully. Today, it doesn't hurt anymore." And Matsu said, "Then you really did understand what happened yesterday." What is it when we don't land anywhere? Then what remains is just this, right now, just you. And that is the totality. Everything is present, nothing is hindered. The whole universe is present, the whole world flows through, this true person of no rank that moves in and out of the senses. And moving in and out of the senses means through sensations, emotions, feelings, thoughts, tastes, touch. What is that? Matsu asks. Zazen is sitting moment by moment, embodying the question and the answer. Being held fast, not flying away. When has anything ever flown away? When we encounter pain in Zazen, we're experiencing form as emptiness. When we see a thought arise and see it pass, we're seeing the display of emptiness as form. But we look and may not yet see. When we see, we may not yet realize. When we realize, we may not have yet integrated. And that's the Buddhist path. That's training. To come out of our hiddenness, to be released from our stuckness, and to see all things as having one essence. And so the ways that we do that are both in traditional training, which is what has come down to us, and in every time, we also do it meeting our time and place, meeting the conditions in which we practice. The Buddha said all of our perceived reality is a result of karma and conditions. It's a result of intentional actions, those of ourselves, those of those around us, those of those we'll never meet, and the conditions, this body and mind, our senses, the physical world, the place where we live, the time in which we live, the circumstances in which we live, the conditions, and all of that together creates in our minds the sense of reality, that which appears before us. How do we stumble past? What are the implications of stumbling past? And so the Dharma brings us to study through our senses this. But there is so much hiddenness that we spend our lifetimes revealing, 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 and seeing more and more how our karma and our, what we call our conditions, are completely interpenetrating, permeated, infused, and penetrating and infusing, in turn, all that is around us. And so when we turn our attention to the environment, to climate change, and try and actively do that which will create less harm and bring more good, we could say to the earth, but the earth is you and me. It's everything. Then we're manifesting what Bai Zhang said, or what Master Matsu said, that the import of Zen is the moment when body and mind do not fly away. See directly. But seeing means to realize and to act, to embody. And so the conditions of our time are the world we're living in. And it is also the karma that we create and that we've created. The we meaning collectively, the we meaning ourselves, our families, the groups that we belong to, as a white person, as a man, as a person, as people growing up in different cultures within this larger culture, within different societies, within this larger society. And so one of the manifestations of that, which is meeting the needs of our time and our person, is the Beyond Fear work. And so I just wanted to mention that on March 3rd, we're going to be having a forum, inviting basically the Sangha to come and look together at the work that we've been doing for since, I don't know, 2005, 6, that we began this in the city and then have been continuing to develop all throughout, and to really share what we've been doing, which has been within different groups within the Sangha all during this time. And to really invite everybody to come in and to share that, and also to invite the Sangha to for us all to work together to meet the past and present and future in our not seeing the ways in which we suffer and create suffering on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, on the basis of the groups that we live in, have been assigned to, the meaning of those groups, the dominance of some groups over others, the pain and suffering, the violence that is perpetrated upon groups by other groups. And we're really talking about people, right? Human beings, you and me. Because this really is the suffering of our time. And it's the karmic suffering of our nation. Everyone who not only lives in this country, but steps into it, is part of it, is subject to it. People around the world, because of the power of this, the reach of this country, is subjected to it. And as Buddhist practitioners, our practice really is about being awake. I mean, really, like for real, right? Like, that's what those vows mean. And so as practitioners, you know, well, part of what we're cultivating is that courage and that not just willingness, but the eagerness, the enthusiasm to hold ourselves fast and see into what needs to be seen. And so, and in that, there's freedom, there's liberation, there's the release from bondage. And, you know, the incredible thing about bodhicitta that happens in so many ways is that part of what we begin to see is the pain of the bondage that we had just thought was life. That the ways we've accommodated ourselves and even benefited from suffering that we create or that we've inherited, that we inflict on others or that we benefit from directly, we begin to see the suffering of that. We didn't see it before. We didn't actually experience it as suffering. It's kind of incredible when you think about it. How could we be suffering and not know it? And yet we all know that, how we suddenly see and experience something that we have been living with all along and now see it differently. And so I really invite you, I want as many of us of the Sangha to be here on the 3rd. That is the day when we're going to begin Ango. So what a wonderful, auspicious time at the beginning of the mountain training to come together and explore this. And that in that liberating work, it's also joyful. You know, and that's one of the things that seems counterintuitive. And yet Buddhism is really a testimony. Even in the Buddha's time, there are accounts of where, you know, just locals, you know, would come to the Buddha or senior disciples and say, you know, you guys, like, you know, you sit in the midst of corpses and you meditate and you contemplate on impermanence and, you know, you do all this stuff that's kind of heavy, but you're kind of a happy group. You know, there's a lightness of being, a joyfulness. What's that about? Right? Because it seems counterintuitive. The way we think we come to joy is by getting as far away from pain as possible. That has never actually been true. And certainly not because we haven't tried hard enough. And so to face what is difficult to face, you know, part of the indicator, part of the messenger is that when we, the strength of our not wanting to like step into this, like what we should, that's the moment when Watsu says, what is that? What is that? If I think the pain of not wanting to step in is because it doesn't have anything to do with me, right? It has nothing to do with my life. What is that? We should wonder. And that the strength of what we may feel as discomfort or resistance is the messenger. We are curious beings. I also wanted to say, as we finish up here, I just wanted to acknowledge, as we say, Sensei is going to be stepping out of her place. I don't know what to call it. The way in which she has been living her life for the last several years since she took off her robes, which you did in 2014. Prior to that, of course, she was a monastic here for many years, and before that in training. And is going to be stepping out and entering the world of the wild and woolly world of householderdom and taking some time off on a sabbatical for a few months and then finding her way into work and place and teaching. and being active within the Sangha and in a new form. And, you know, change can always, you know, we're creatures of habit. And so we often like things to stay the way they are. And so it's part of Sangha practice and reality and training. In fact, it is training to experience the different ways that impermanence appears within a Sangha. You know, how people come and go, how people are born and die, how we age, how we develop in our practice, how people in different sort of positions or levels of commitment, how that sometimes stays steady all the way through the end, and sometimes it changes and takes another form. And I really feel like when, you know, a person is practicing and they're sincere, that that is the fruitful and radiant unfolding of their path. That it, nothing is permanent, and that no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, we may think that we're going to enter and we're going to do this and this is what it's going to be like in 10 years, but we don't actually know. We don't know nothing about that. And so I see this as a natural and healthy and straight ahead part of your development and our development, because we're all in this together. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that and wish you well, great leaping forward and love. So maybe we'll just end with that.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.